Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Mark Steeds from Bristol Radical History Group takes us through the RAC, the SMV and the SSC, that is, the Royal African Company, the Society of Merchant Venturers and the South Seas Company, to you and I, with a look at the possible legacy of the slave trade here in Bristol and having a permanent memorial, a kind of history hub of some sort. Also, Will Stone is here from Avon and Bristol Law Centre looking at the changes to the law on employment tribunals, which mean that people won't have to pay fees, and possibly people will be able to take cases where they would have had to pay fees in the past for free. And E. Michael Jones on his book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, and I'll give contact details at the end of the show. I'm joined now by Mark Steeds. He's a member of Bristol Radical History Group, behind one of their pamphlets, or one of the co-authors of Cry Freedom, Cry Seven Stars. Now, Mark, what are the seven stars?
The seven stars, the plough in the sky, if you like, a navigational aid. A couple of pubs in Bristol were named after that. In the countryside, they're called the Plough. And it's special significance in Bristol because the one pub, the Seven Stars, in St. Thomas Lane, was where Thomas Clarkson came in 1787 to start his great campaign to try and get the slave trade abolished.
So whereabouts is that in Bristol? And who was this Thomas Clarkson chap?
Well, commonly it's next to the Fleece, just off of Victoria Street there. And Thomas Clarkson was, some people call him Wilberforce's foot soldier, but he was more than that. He was the man who did the first real human rights campaign to get the slave trade banned, as Samuel Taylor Coleridge called him, the giant with one idea, the moral steam engine, he called him. He was the kiddie. He was really the man that made it happen.
How did he do it? How did he get the slave trade abolished?
Well, he campaigned vigorously. A lot of things came into their favour at the same time, petitioning, pamphleting, that sort of thing. When he came to Bristol, he was introduced to Landlord Thompson of the Seven Stars by a Quaker called Harry Gandy. And these people were great organisers, and they sort of backed him. And with Thompson's help, he was able to go to all the sort of sailors. He was introduced to various sailors. He realised their conditions they were kept in, the way they were being put onto ships against their will. They were being kidnapped, shanghaied, and all the rest of it, put into debt.
This is just the sailors, let alone the slaves.
Oh, yeah. And he was able to go to the customs house in Bristol and see for 1786 that of the 1,000 sailors employed in the slave trade in Bristol at that time, only half of them came home. 250 deserted, and the other 250 actually died on it. People did not want to go on it. It was something they didn't want to do.
But I'll just bring you back to how he actually got it abolished. Did he go around banging on merchants' doors? I mean, was there marches through the streets? How did he do it?
The pamphleting and the petitioning were great things. But you've got to realise that the vested interests of the West India merchants was huge. The money was huge. Even in those days, if you voted against them, you would lose your franchise, if you lot. You would be put out of business. All sorts of tricks they used to go against it.
Is this the merchant venturers or who?
People like the merchant venturers. Most of the West India merchants were merchant venturers. Those people with vested interests. They were a minority, but they had a real stranglehold on the power in the city. And it wasn't just Bristol, it was Liverpool as well. After he left Bristol, he went to Liverpool and he was nearly assassinated. You know, he, a very brave man. He fought these people all over the place.
Can you just paint a picture of this Thomas Clarkson guy? What was his background? And who was he?
Well, he was a clergyman from Wisbeach in, I forget where, I think it's in Cambridgeshire. He went to Cambridge. His dad died young, but he was fairly wealthy. He went to Cambridge, and he was impressed by the works of a chap called Anthony Benezet, who was a Quaker abolitionist who was based in America. He read his writings. He was stirred up by that. And as it happened, his lecturer at Cambridge wanted him to, he set all of his students an essay competition about the slave trade. His tutor was against the slave trade as well. And using Benezet's works, he did his essay. That became a best-selling pamphlet as well. With that essay, it stirred him up. This was 1785. He'd sort of sat down and said, I must do something about this. He didn't quite say I am the person, but it stirred him up so much to say that someone must put this tragedy to an end, and it set him on the road.
But you said he was up against vested interests. Just how much money were merchants like Edward Colston and et cetera making from this trade?
Well, Colston predated him by 80 odd years, but the money was fantastic. I mean, Colston made £170,000 out of his dealings with the slave trade, effectively. And when he died in 1721, in today's terms, that would be worth £500 million. They were making a triple profit on what they were doing. You know,
how do you mean a triple profit?
A triple profit. They were supplying the goods to trade with the Africans for the Africans to then be put on ships. They were supplying the ships. They were insuring the ships. They were then taking them off to the Americas, to the West Indies. They were then selling the slaves, and then they were buying produce back to then bring it back to Britain.
And is this the Royal Africa Company? And what was their relationship with Bristol's merchant venturers?
Well, the Royal African Company was really a 17th century construct. The Society of Merchant Venturers were against them in the early days of the slave trade, and the SMVs only really got into it in 1698 after petitioning for 40 years to get involved with the African trade. As their power grew, so the Royal African Company's power decreased. But they were all in the trade together, if you like. And then after the RAC, or in tangent with, or in parallel with the RAC, you then got the South Seas Company, who managed to get the Asiento, the sole rights to trade with Africans for the Spanish Empire. They got that in 1713, thanks to a Bishop of Bristol who managed to negotiate that. And that ensured then for another 30 years, in addition to what they were supplying to the British Empire, or fledgling British Empire, they were also supplying to the Spanish Empire.
So do you think we're right to concentrate on Edward Colston as one of the key people in this trade?
Well, he's been over-memorialised in Bristol, so he is everywhere. There's over 28, 30-odd things named in his honour. And you'd think no one else existed in Bristol. So, yes, you are right to have a look at Edward Colston. But you also, in fairness, you should be putting other people up on pedestals, people who fought it, like Hannah Moore, people like that, local
people. So who was she?
Hannah Moore, she was a playwright. She was an educated lady from Fish Ponds, born in 1740. Very rare for a woman to be educated in those days. She was a very popular writer. She turned her back on the theatre and became interested in evangelicalism. And through John Newton, the great anti-slavery campaigner, former slave ship captain, she got interested in the campaign to ban the slave trade.
Well, that's amazing. So a captain actually turned almost like a poacher turned gamekeeper.
Oh, exactly right. Well, quite a few were. Harry Gandhi were. John Newton, he was the fellow who ended up to be a great hymn writer. He actually wrote Amazing Grace, and that became the anthem of abolition.
Eventually, it was down to Parliament to decide. But before that, Colston himself became an MP, didn't he?
Yes, he was. 1710, he was Bristol MP. A crucial time. He used his experience on the RAC with the Asiento, and he no doubt helped get that treaty through that enabled the South Seas Company to thrive. He did various things while he was while he was an MP. Yeah.
What about the potential to remember this? Because I know you've been to Nantes recently in France. What was Nantes' role in the slave trade, and what did you find there?
Well, Nantes was like a French Bristol, if you like. It was an inland port, in their case the Loire rather than the Avon, and it was a stronghold. Many voyages set off from Nantes. They had the same sort of merchant structure, if you like, as Bristol. Over 2,000 voyages went out, which is another similar amount as to what happened in Bristol. But in Nantes, they've looked at it, looked at the situation, realised they needed to reconcile that part of their past, and without pointing any fingers, they put 8,500 square metre part of their quayside over to a memorial park and a proper memorial as well set down into the quay.
So that sounds quite big. What's actually there? You visited it recently.
Well, it's a landscape park. It was sort of part... So again, like Bristol, they've gone through schisms of change since industry's gone out of the place. So they had this spare bit of land. They were shipbuilders, just like Bristol were. And they decided to use part of it as a memorial park and as a memorial. And it's beautifully done with plaques set in glass into the quayside, a bit like a ship's hull going into the quayside with the river on one side. And they've actually got a place where you can remember and reflect, which is something we're crying out for in Bristol.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, it's peculiar. I mean, I've visited the M Shed, which has got a very small exhibition about slavery and Bristol's involvement, but doesn't even mention the Merchant Ventures anywhere in there. I mean, it's got some facts and figures. It does seem that there might be an argument for something similar to Nantes here in Bristol. Is there anywhere that anyone's looking at the moment as a potential?
Yes, there are. There's some old dockside buildings that would be ripe for making a proper museum and sort of memorial, right next to Redcliffe Bridge, actually. They're the last buildings that haven't been sort of developed, if you like. They go back to 1883, and they'd be a perfect candidate if the council wanted to move away from its penchant for bars and restaurants.
Now, local people around Welshback aren't really happy about having more bars and restaurants either.
No, they're not. And they see that building as a history hub. And what perfect history than reconciliation of the slave trade?
Some would say, look, this was a horrible time in Bristol's history, best forgotten.
You can't forget it. No. And it would be wrong to forget it. It goes on to this day. I mean, and so many great Bristolians put their lives on the line for it.
Hang on a minute. The slave trade was abolished 200 years ago.
Well, the trade was abolished 200 years ago, but emancipation didn't come until 1833. 1834 it got passed in Parliament, and in 1838 you finally got a cessation in slavery, as it were. But in order to circumvent that, the merchant venturers, again, if you like, they were shipping people over from the subcontinent, India, and from Hong Kong, coolie labour, they were calling it, and they were supplanting the slaves, who were now trying to work for money, and they were supplanting them with indentured labourers, if you like, again, coming from the subcontinent, as I say. And it's gone 200 years and thousands of miles from indentured labourers from Britain going out to indentured servants coming in again, you know, and it was all the while is for these people to make money.
That's but even Cabot and the slave trade, Cabot's reconnaissance of genocide in North America and the slave trade that followed it is not the start, is it? Because actually slavery in Bristol goes back to Saxon times.
Yes, it does, yeah. St. Wolstan got the slave trade banned in Bristol in 1090.
Good old St. Wolstan, well done.
Yeah, patron saint of peasants and vegetarians, yeah. And you don't hear about him in the middle of Bristol. It's wicked. But it wasn't only the Saxon trade. You mentioned Cabot. It was more his son Sebastian who was involved. He went into the employ of the Spanish and ended up in Brazil. He shipped Africans to Brazil. He took Amerindians and brought them back to Seville and had them as his house slaves, if you like. You know, so if you're pointing a finger at Cabot, it's more his son than John.
But let me drag you back to before 1066. Where was that Saxon trade taking place, and why was it Bristol the hub?
Bristol was just one of the hubs. Chester was another place. I mean, at the time, the Vikings controlled Dublin, and they made Dublin the market, the mart for their slaves to go out through the Viking Empire. They had good contacts with Bristol and Chester, as I say, for getting slaves over there. This is the poor of Bristol, the people who'd lost their possessions, the street urchins, if you liked. Wolfston mentions it, actually. He preached every Sunday for months on end in the slave pens, which are now in Baldwin Street, but it was the old course of the River Frome. He preached there, and they had this, you know, it was the youth of England going out with blonde hair and everything all shackled up. And they had a nasty habit of putting the young women with child. you know, adding value to their cargoes, you know, despicable tricks that they would do again 500, 600, 700 years later. Amazing. And what always gets me, if it was bad in 1090, why did they resurrect it again 1590, 1690, 1790? You know, what was the moral, where was their moral compass? You know?
Well, a lot of people today would say they're in wage slavery with, I mean, maybe pushing a point, but with ridiculously low pay and rents that they simply can't afford to pay. So they ended up with getting paid, sometimes even for a full-time job, less than their cost of living.
Yeah, it's wicked.
So, I mean, is it? Do you think it's stretching a point to compare the slave trade to that sort of modern economic slavery?
No, I don't think it is, no. I mean, one of the criticisms of the abolitionists, like Wilberforce and so on, was they cared more about the slaves than they did for the young of Britain going up chimneys and so on. In fact, it wasn't until 1875 that the Factories Act spread out of the cotton factories to all child labour. So all of a sudden, children up to the age of 10 were made to go to school. That didn't happen until 1785. You know, that's a long time after emancipation came to the West Indies.
Why is it, do you think, that Bristol still hasn't actually got a history hub or something that can show the full spread of the city's involvement with slavery over the centuries?
I don't know. It's very disappointing. It is. I mean, several times they've had an opportunity to do something, like with the Festival of the Sea, and they didn't even look at the slave trade when they were doing that. They had, again, another opportunity in 2007, but it was muddied. You know, people didn't know what they were celebrating for whom and by whom. You know, it's all.
Now we've got
no direction. No one's come along and said, you know, this is something we must do. You know, this is our past. This is our future.
Well, we've got a West Indian mixed race mayor now, Marvin Rees, Labour mayor. Do you think it's going to make any difference?
It'd be a great opportunity for him to get in and do something. Yeah.
Is he interested in this? Do you think?
I don't know. I honestly don't.
Well,
know.
We shall find out.
Yeah. Okay. I hope he is.
And Mark, whereabouts can people find Bristol Radical History, both online or actually in the flesh?
Well, they do various events every year, all sorts of things they put on for people just to come along at the Cube and all sorts of venues that they can get hold of. I mean, if they had a proper history hub in Welshback, they could have that as a sort of community space. But the best place is on their website, which is all the W's, brhg.org.uk.
And if the people are interested in supporting the History Hub, is there anything they can do?
Just talk about it. Just put letters to the paper or you know, come in and talk to you, Tony.
Okay.
All sorts of things.
Okay, Mark, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined by Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Actually, before we start, Will, can you just tell us a bit about the Law Centre, how you operate, how you're funded, that sort of thing?
Yeah, the Law Centre is a not-for-profit charity. We offer legal advice, representation and in various areas of social welfare law. So I do employment law, I do discrimination law. We also do welfare benefits, immigration, mental health and housing. So we offer advice, we offer representation in various areas of social welfare law. I myself do employment law and discrimination law. That's not just in employment, but in goods and services as well. We also do welfare benefits, we do housing, we do immigration, and we do mental health law. And it's funded by various sources. Some of the work, like mental health, for example, is funded through the Legal Aid Agency. Other work, such as the work that I do myself, is funded through various grants that come from Bristol City Council. We've also recently done some work funded by the Equalities and Human Rights Commission.
But as I understand it, there's very little people can get under legal aid now. There were big cuts from the 2010 coalition government.
Legal aid is very different now from when I started working at the Law Centre. there's very limited legal aid. It is still available. For example, in housing, it used to be available for taking disrepair. It's now only available if your house, you're actually at risk of losing your home. Immigration is now only available for asylum seekers and refugees. Very limited circumstances. Employment, I used to do quite a number of employment cases and that were funded through legal aid, and that funding has gone completely.
What about, because the time people need a solicitor, particularly if they don't have money, is when they are, I mean, we're all prone to this, barrack room lawyers, when you're in a certain situation, whether it's to do with housing, employment, or something to do with the way you're living your life, and you think, well, I actually just need a bit of legal advice. Is it still possible to get, you know, whatever, 15 minutes, half an hour, free legal advice to see if a case might be worth pursuing?
There are various options that we've got at the Law Centre. For example, myself, the kind of work that I do, employment law, we do have an employment law advice line which operates every Tuesday between 4 o'clock and 6 o'clock, and any Bristol City resident can ring that number and get some legal advice. We also have a lot of help that we get from local lawyers who offer their services free for our volunteer advice services, which are available on, again, I think that's on Tuesday evening. People ring our reception. They can be booked an appointment to see a lawyer about an employment matter or about a family matter, a personal injury matter, or about a general civil litigation. Like if you've bought a car and it stopped working and you want to know how to sue the person that sold you the car.
What about things like religious discrimination? I'm thinking about anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, this sort of thing.
Certainly, that's the kind of work that I myself do. There's myself, as my colleague Syra. We both run a service which, up until recently, has been funded by Bristol City Council under the Tackling Discrimination Service. That's available to all Bristol City Council members. It's recently we've got a new grant where we're working now much more closely in collaboration with other local equalities organisations like SARI, Support Against Racism and Inequality, Bristol Mind, the Bristol LGBT Forum, Bristol Women's Voice. We're gathering together under, I think it's called the Bristol Hate Crime and Discrimination Services. It's going to be officially launched later on this year, where people will be able to contact us and get free advice on any discrimination matter, whether that's religious discrimination, race discrimination, sexual orientation discrimination, or any of the other prohibited discrimination characteristics under the Equality Act.
Because, hate crime, we tend to think of as something which is Abu Qatada, these various so-called hate preachers, almost all of them with some connection. But there are other sorts of hate crime too, aren't there? Particularly things like what used to be the National Front, BNP, that sort of hate crime seems to be not so much reported, but it's still there.
It's still there, and certainly I know that my colleagues in SARI are dealing with people who suffer racist hate crime, sexual orientation hate crime against people with disabilities as well. We deal with a lot of people who experience terrible kind of abuse, sometimes even from their neighbours, people who are living next door to them, simply because they've got a disability, simply because they look different, they act different, and they have to suffer all sorts of abuse and harassment as a result.
Now, you're a particular area, I mean, you do several things, but one of them is employment law, and you've had a bit of a victory, haven't you? Well, it's actually been quite a long time in coming.
But yeah, there's last week, last Wednesday, in fact, I think it was, I walked into work and I was greeted with somebody jumping up and down and saying the Supreme Court have just abolished employment tribunal fees. Of course, I immediately got a copy of the judgment, and yes, the Supreme Court established that the employment tribunal fees, which were put in place nearly 4 years ago now, so it's quite a long time, finally ruled that the case that was brought with the help of Unison, the independent workers' union of Great Britain as well, and with the support of the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, had finally succeeded and declared that those fees were unlawful, and they were immediately abolished. And in fact, the Employment Tribunal website was immediately taken down. That kind of caused problems for people who wanted to make claims and perhaps were stuck on a very tight time limit. It is, I've seen today, back up, down, running, so people can make a claim back online to the employment tribunal, and they won't have to pay a fee.
So that's just quite important, isn't it? Because there's all sorts of reasons why people may feel that they've been unfairly dismissed. The law is quite complex. It changes quite a bit. And employers do tend to think that they can sack anyone at any time. There's that sort of arrogance that comes with a labour market where they can find a new replacement employee quite easily. But what is the law, effectively? If someone has been sacked, how do they know whether they may have some rights to compensation?
Well, you've still got to have 2 years' service. Unfortunately, that hasn't been changed. It used to be 1 year. It was increased to 2 years many moons ago. It was then reduced back down to 1 year because a case had been taken which showed that having a two-year time limit, in fact, discriminated, generally speaking, against women workers as opposed to men workers. But a few years ago, it was increased back to 2 years. That hasn't been challenged yet. That remains to be seen as to whether anybody will challenge that. But my advice is, if you've got your 2 years' service, get advice. Also, there are certain circumstances where you don't need to have any time that you've served with your employer in order to have employment protection rights. If, for example, somebody who's complained about health and safety in the workplace and then finds themselves dismissed for some spurious reason, can take a claim of what's called automatic unfair dismissal, which means if you can establish that your complaint about health and safety was part of the reason that you were dismissed, you don't need to have.
But that's very difficult to establish, isn't it? As an employer will say, well, I've actually sacked you because you weren't properly dressed today. Actually, it's nothing to do with the fact that you have caused me all sorts of trouble through health and safety and pointing out that some of our practices are unsafe. So employers are quite clever, aren't they, at saying, actually, no, it was nothing to do with that.
That's true, but that's why it's important to have good quality legal advice and representation, because as a lawyer, the first thing that I do is that I look at the evidence.
If you as an employee suspect that maybe an employer is trying to get rid of you, is there anything you can do to try and make sure that you're gathering evidence that might be useful to you if you come to an employment tribunal?
In these kind of cases, the burden of proof would usually be on the employer. So, for example, if you're saying I've been unfairly dismissed, then provided your employer agrees that they dismissed you, then the burden of proof is on your employer to show that it was a fair dismissal. So you don't really have to show anything. That's the job for your employer to do. Also, there are various rules around evidence. Does have to be disclosed. Yes, of course. You know, an unscrupulous employer could delete a whole load of emails. So it might be kind of wise to save some, not all, emails. I mean, tribunals don't like trawling through pages and pages and pages of emails, but the important ones are the ones that you want to get to.
You must have represented quite a lot of people in these cases. Can you, without giving names, give us an example of the sort of thing where you actually did manage to get someone some compensation, where the employer was adamant that the person was fairly dismissed?
Yeah, okay. So, in fact, it was one of the first cases that I took at the law centre, and it was against an employer who's a national employer. They were, at that time, quite big employers, doing kind of agency work, security services in the Bristol area, and they dismissed my client whilst she was pregnant. They said that it was a redundancy. She said, that's nonsense. I'm not redundant. In fact, somebody has already walked into my job. This was a dismissal because I was pregnant. This was an unfair dismissal. We took them to the employment tribunal. What was interesting about it was that the day before the actual hearing, their head of human resources rang me and said to me, oh, come on, Mr. Stone, you don't seriously believe that we would dismiss a woman just because you're pregnant in this day and age, was the phrase that she used. And I said, well, A, it's not really very appropriate for me to discuss that with you now. That's a matter for the tribunal to decide the next day. And in fact, we walked the floor with them, and the tribunal were utterly convinced that none of their explanations as to why she was made redundant were actually made out at all. Again, you know, it's for the employer there to provide the evidence, to provide the proof that the reasons that they're saying that she was dismissed were cogent reasons, and in fact, they couldn't do that.
Okay, so these employment fees that we've now seen abolished, how much were they and how long have they been enforced for?
Since July 2013, so that's 4 years, if you wanted to take a discrimination claim, in order to go all the way to a final hearing, it would cost you £1,200. That's a lot of money for a lot of people. There were also other claims. For example, if you were just owed some wages, it would cost you about £400. Now, what's important is to contrast that with if you went to the small claims court, because you, as an employee, you have a choice of going to an employment tribunal or going to the small claims court if you're recovering wages that you're owed. If you go to the small claims court, the fee is set according to the amount that you're claiming. So if you're claiming up to £300, it's only 25 quid, for example. If you're claiming up to £1,000, it might be 80 quid. But in all cases, it's going to be at least, to start the claim, £165 in the employment tribunal. So we were having to advise people who had good claims that really should have gone before the employment tribunal, because employment tribunals are used to dealing with these claims. They're very efficient at dealing with these claims, and they know exactly what they're looking at. If you go to the small claims court, it's a much more complicated, potentially can be quite difficult, because the judge may not be a judge that's used to looking at employment, but it would be cheaper to do that. So we were having to advise people, well, you know, it's cheaper, actually cheaper in this case, for you to go to the small claims court than it is to go to the employment tribunal.
Now, look, the imposition of these fees must have stopped a lot of people from actually taking claims. Is there going to be any kind of ability for people to take claims now that they couldn't afford at the time?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. That's something that a lot of lawyers like myself were all kind of talking to ourselves about, what the possibility of doing that is. I personally know clients that I advised to take claims and did not take those claims because they just simply couldn't afford to take the fees. What's going to happen to those kind of cases, we really don't know. We'll have to have a look and see what happens. Somebody will need to take a case and we'll have to get some.
Isn't there a time limit? I might be wrong, but isn't it 6 months after you've been dismissed, you've got to actually bring a case within 6 months?
Oh, it's much shorter than that. It's 3 months. It's really not very long. So it's not very long for you to get your case together to think about, get some advice,
that's
and then
terrible,
think,
Will,
do I
because
want to
for
take
a lot of people, when they lose a job like that, they can be in shock for a few weeks, you know, trying to pull their lives back together, trying to get an income, possibly dealing with not being able to pay the rent, this sort of thing. And so actually 3 months is a very short period of time for you to be able to go to a tribunal.
It's a very short period of time. And for unfair dismissal cases, it's very, very difficult to get it extended because it's pretty much an absolute time limit. So even if you're 1 day late, unless you can show, for example, the usual example that we give is that you've been run over by a bus and you were in intensive care in hospital. Unless it's something like that, it's very difficult to get the time limit extended. It's much more easy in discrimination cases because the tribunal can have a regard to whether or not it's just and equitable in all the circumstances. So if, in fact, you'd gone into depression or you'd found that it was that the anxiety of taking a cane was too much and you could support that with a letter from your GP or something like that, then it's more than likely that, provided it wasn't too long, the tribunal would probably extend the time limit.
What about a letter from your lawyer saying that fees were too high?
We don't know. That is quite an interesting one. Somebody, for example, who decided that they weren't going to take a claim last Tuesday and were then out of time, heard on the Wednesday that the fees had been abolished, thought, well, maybe I'll try and put in a claim now, found that the claim form online service was down, and so they couldn't actually submit the claim, and now puts a claim in now, potentially has a very valid argument to say, look, this wasn't my fault. It's now just and equitable to extend the time limit because the fees, which was the reason I didn't put the claim in, has now been declared completely unlawful.
So the idea is, if you or someone you know has been unfairly dismissed or thinks they have, go and see yourself or another lawyer as soon as possible.
Yeah, I'd get some advice straight away, really. As I said, people can ring us on our employment advice line on a Tuesday evening.
Can you give us the numbers and the number tell for us that, where you are?
Yeah, the number for that is 0117 1-6-7-7-2-7. It's only on a Tuesday. It's only between 4 and 6. But if it's a discrimination matter, you can contact us at any time. That's not a problem. We can advise on discrimination at all times. And the number to ring there is 0117-924-8662. That's our reception number.
Okay, Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre, which is just up the Stokescroft direction from the Bear Pit. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Ted.
On Dialect. That was Avon and Bristol Law Centre solicitor Will Stone. And his numbers again, 0117 916 7727. And that is for the Employment Advice Line. That's every Tuesday between 4 and 6 p.m. The number 0117 916 7727. If you want to phone generally any time during the day, during the week, it's 0117 924 8662. That's 0117 924 8662 for reception, and the service is available to all Bristol residents.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is E. Michael Jones. I received a PhD in American literature in 1979 from Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I thought I was going to be an academic, got fired 1 year after I was hired as an assistant professor of American literature at a Catholic college for being against abortion. In 1981, I started a magazine, which was called Fidelity at that point, and now it's called Culture Wars. So I've been doing this for going on 40 years now.
Now, this book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, what made you choose that title? Why this subject? What made you delve into this one?
There were two things. First of all, the first was Daniel Jonah Goldhagen's attack on Pius XII. This came roughly 40 years after the Second Vatican Council, which was supposed to open a new era of cooperation between Jews and Catholics. It turned out that it didn't turn out that way at all. It was just one unrelieved attack after another, and Goldhagen's book was the worst in this regard because it deliberately falsified the data. He put words into Pius XII's mouth. I guess he assumed that no American could read either Italian or German. Anyway, it was an atrocious book. Disservice to scholarship. The second thing was the neoconservative takeover of American foreign policy, which eventuated in the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Over this period of time, we in America had become conscious of a group that was known as neoconservatives. And they had basically taken over our foreign policy. But the main thing that I noticed was that all the leading figures were Jews, and no one was allowed to talk about this. And I thought, there's something bigger going on here. And that led me to assess both the whole Catholic Church's commitment to dialogue with the Jews, beginning with the Second Vatican Council, the Jews' involvement in American politics, and basically an understanding of what a Jew was, because at the beginning of this, it wasn't clear. Was it an ethnic group? Was it a religion? Was it an ideology? What was it?
Okay, maybe you can clear that up to begin with. What is Jewishness?
Jewishness, I basically take a theological approach in my book. The book begins with the arrival of Jesus Christ on this earth. The Jews at this moment in history were known as God's chosen people. At that moment, when Jesus Christ arrives as the Messiah, the Jews have to exercise free will. God is not going to deprive them of their free will. They have to accept the Messiah on his terms, not their terms. They would like a powerful military leader who would restore Israel. They said this a number of times to Jesus. Jesus had a different view. Eventually, the Jewish leaders and the Jewish people decided they didn't like this guy. This was not the Messiah they wanted, and they conspired with the Romans to have him killed. Now, when you're talking about Jesus Christ, you're talking about the second person of the Blessed Trinity. You're also talking about what the evangelist would refer to as the Word of God or the Logos. The first three sentences of St. John's Gospel say basically, in the beginning there was Logos, which is the Greek word for speech, rational order, rationality, reason, four pages of words in the Greek-English dictionary. And it says that Logos is God. Now, when you kill the Logos, you're in rebellion. You're basically rebelling against the order of the universe. When you rebel against the order of the universe as created by God, you're known as a revolutionary. I'm saying at this point we have the birth of what I call the Jewish revolutionary spirit.
But surely, I mean, this was going on long, long before that. I mean, there were revolutions against Moses, for example, within from amongst the Jews themselves, weren't there, a long time before Jesus?
Well, I think you're using the term revolution in an expanded sense of the word here. What I'm referring to occurred within 30 years, 35 years of the death of Jesus Christ, namely the rebellion against the Roman Empire. Most Jews are a communist or Marxist. This changed during that period of time leading up to now. The 1967 war was a crucial moment in this regard because that moment also coincided with the breakup of the Black Jewish Alliance, which had been the foremost achievement of the Black Jewish Alliance was the civil rights movement in the 1960s. It broke up, and as a result, the Jews in America shifted their allegiance mainly from Marxism to Zionism. So they're two competing ideologies for the Jewish mind. All of the neoconservatives, the founding fathers, a guy like Irving Kristol, he was a Trotskyite during the 1930s. Over this period of time, he shifted away and created conservatism as the new front for the Jewish revolutionary spirit. In other words, to get back to my initial moment here, this is confusing. I mean, all Jews were leftists at a certain point, and now we got this group calling themselves conservatives. This doesn't make any sense politically. You know, you can't align them on the political spectrum. Well, that's why I think you need a term like the Jewish revolutionary spirit in order to understand what's going on. Because the one constant, I mean, there is a virtual constancy or identity between Trotskyism and neoconservatism. I think that Irving Kristol and his son carried a lot of this over into this new political movement. But it's a revolutionary movement. The difference is that now they're using the United States as the vehicle for the revolution, whereas in the 1920s they used the Soviet Union as the vehicle for revolution.
What couple of take-homes would you like people to get from your book, particularly when it comes to history? Because it's quite interesting sometimes when we take a look at history, we find that things weren't quite the way we thought they were.
You're right. The problem is no one's allowed to talk about this. As soon as you say something that Jews don't like, you're called an anti-Semite. And this has a chilling, chilling effect on any type of historical investigation and on any type of political activism. So, I mean, the point here is that this contradicts everything that we say we believe as Americans. In other words, we're supposed to have a freedom of the press, we're supposed to have a freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, all these things. All these things are directly contradicted right now by the Israel lobby and its control over the American political situation. To give you the most current example of this, the boycott movement is now on the verge of being declared illegal. In other words, if you support the boycotting Israel, boycotting Israeli products, you can, according to the bill as it stands now, you may end up in jail for 20 years and paying a fine of $250,000. Now, there's no other group in the United States or in the world that I know of that is immune from criticism. that you can't criticize an entity, that you can't say, well, I'm not going to buy their products. There's no other group in the world. And the point I'm trying to make here is that the fact that this bill has gotten as far as it has is a sign of the total control that the Israel lobby has over the American political system. Another example I could give you is Benjamin Netanyahu and the infamous 27 standing ovations. This was a disgusting display of the fawning nature of our Congress when it comes to the Israel lobby. This is reported in the New York Times. The representatives of IPAC are there, the American Israel Political Action Committee. They're there in the Congress, in the room, with their notepads. And if you don't stand up, you don't get any money. So they had to do it 27 times. So this is an intolerable situation. And all I'm trying to say here is that this book is an attempt to put this intolerable situation into some type of historical context.
Okay, so is there any way this is going to change?
First of all, this is part of the oligarchic control of the entire world that the United States is imposing on the entire world.
Well, hang on, including Russia and China?
No. I mean, it's not, you know, there are pockets of resistance. Iran, Russia, China. Yeah, you've named some of the pockets of resistance against this. But I mean, that's why the Congress is now threatening sanctions again against Russia and Iran. That's the other bill, completely under the thumb of the Israel lobby. The only reason the Congress is proposing these bills, Iran fulfills its obligation on the nuclear agreement, and the Congress just treats it with contempt and piles more sanctions on a country that is negotiating with the United States with goodwill. What I was going to mention was the fact that the Trump election was an uprising against oligarchic rule. And now all the people who voted for him, or most of the people who voted for him, are just totally disappointed in what he's doing with Israel and the Middle East. I mean, his performance in Saudi Arabia was atrocious. I mean, these are the sponsors of terrorism, and he's there with his crystal ball and siding with Israel. And there's a contradiction here. The people who voted for him voted for America First. That's what they channeled. Steve Bannon channeled this from the 1930s, which was basically withdraw from all these foreign entanglements and build up the industrial infrastructure of the United States again. The only good thing I've heard about is that he's cutting off the funds to ISIS in Syria. He apparently did make an agreement with the Russians. They're going to cut those funds off, and so they're not going to try to depose Assad anymore.
What about the Rothschild family then? There are a lot of stories about them being very powerful, all powerful, with all these various places around Europe where various branches of the family put down roots. What do you think is the truth or otherwise to the power that they seem to have over monarchs and over governments?
Well, they came into power in the 19th century in England. Basically, Meyer Amschel Rothschild was in the Judengasse in Frankfurt when Napoleon is marching through the Germanies. The Prince of Hesse-Cassel's got to get the gold out of town. He gives it to Meyer Amschel. Meyer Amschel ships it over to Nathan, who's in London. Nathan bets the gold on the British consul, because he has advance information that Wellington won the Battle of Waterloo. He made a killing, an absolute killing, and this was the establishment of the real Rothschild fortune. For the rest of the 19th century, the Rothschild family lent that money out at interest and basically enslaved the entire English aristocracy in debt. The best example of this is the Churchill family. One of your historians, I forget his name now, wrote a book called Churchill and the Jews, which is a complete cover-up of the whole situation. But there's a picture on the front of it, and it's Winston Churchill's father, Randolph Churchill, sitting next to Natty Rothschild. What they didn't say in the book is that Randolph Churchill died £80,000 in debt to the Rothschilds. They forgave the debt, but they got Winston as their prize, and Winston represented their interest for the rest of his political life. This is the sad story of what happened to the English ruling class by falling into debt over the course of the 19th century.
Do you think there's going to be any way for, not just here in Britain, but in other parts of the world, particularly here in Europe, obviously, to wriggle out of this kind of straitjacket of debt?
No, you can't. That's the whole point of debt. That's the whole point of Greece, and that's the whole point of Germany. The English discovered this with Adam Smith and Lord Townsend. They tried to lay their debt, which is basically from the beginning of the Bank of England, after 70 years, floating loans become unrepayable. So they said, let the Americans pay it. Well, that led to the American Revolution. That's the only way to get out of debt. It's revolution. And it's the only thing that the Greeks can do at this point is overthrow the government and institute their own government, because sovereign debt, floating loans, are unrepayable. Everybody knows this. Adam Smith knew it. Everybody knows this. And all of these bailouts are basically the money goes split second through Athens back to the bank again. Same thing with all the bailouts in South America. I mean, it's an intolerable system.
You're one of the few people that's had a good look at the banking system. Are there any kind of fixes? I mean, people like, for example, the citizens of Iceland seem to have done reasonably well in dealing with
Absolutely.
The bankers.
Absolutely.
So what should we do as Europeans?
Stiff the debt. Do what the Icelanders did, as opposed to the Irish. Okay, the Icelanders said basically, okay, the British were involved in that, wrecking their banks, okay? But it was when it came to the default, okay, the people of Iceland said, look, the guy who owns the bank, he lives right down that street there, so you go and get the money from him, but we're not going to pay. We're not responsible for his recklessness. And you're the British banks, the city's collusion in wrecking those banks. Well, that was the right thing to do. So what do they say at this time? We'll never lend you money again. Well, fat chance. They're banging at Iceland's door to lend the money, because they know how you can control them. So you have to default on your debt. Russia did it. You have to do it. It's just that simple. Greece will have to do it. It's that simple. You can't repay it. There's no way to repay these debts.
And what's the consequence of not doing that then, Michael?
Slavery. It's in Confessions of an Economic Hitman, basically. This guy was hired to go into get countries like Ecuador into debt. And so basically when the debt becomes unrepayable, they say, okay, we know you can't pay. What we want now is the Parthenon, and we want Lesbos, and we want the airport and all your natural resources. At this point, you have to stiff the international community. This what was the purpose of the British Navy? What was the purpose of the British Navy? It was there to collect debts. I described the Don Pacifico affair in Baron Metal. Basically, some dude convinced the British that he was a British citizen, and so they sent warships to Piraeus to bombard Athens so that they would pay back a debt. The British Navy was Leviathan. It's the sea monster. That's what it's there to do. And so what you need, what all of these countries in the world to do is need some way to unite and say, we're not paying at all. We've paid you more money than you lent us by tenfold. It's over. We're not doing it anymore.
Okay. Well, what about the situation in the Middle East at the moment? We've got a lot of tension, as usual, in Jerusalem. Is there any way to diffuse that, do you think?
I think that this is going to take on a life of its own. There is when you say, is there any way to diffuse it? You're asking me, if I were God, if I were king of the world, what would I do? I don't think it's working that way. I think you have to look at basically something like the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 2006. They sent the tanks in. They got 500 yards into Lebanon, and they were stopped dead in their tracks. Hezbollah, 1,500 Hezbollah guys stopped the mighty Israeli army, and they went back with their tails between their legs. What is happening here? I think what happened here is that you have a change in military technology, and that the tank is now obsolete. I think the same thing has happened with the aircraft carrier. The aircraft carrier is now a piece of obsolete technology. Both have been rendered obsolete by missiles. And so there is a historical trajectory that will now take place because of these facts. And I don't know what it's going to be, because I don't know what's going to happen the next time. Hezbollah, Israel is very upset because Iran basically has erected a Shia crescent around Israel. Iran, the Shia government in Iraq, Syria, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Hamas in the Gaza Strip.
And so is some sort of a clash there inevitable then? Is that what you're saying?
I think there is. I think that basically they're going to push it, and we would all hope for a peaceful solution, but sometimes it doesn't work out that way. Israel hasn't invaded Lebanon again in 11 years. They used to do this on a regular basis. They love to go in and beat those people up on a regular basis. They haven't done it for 11 years, and I think it's a recognition that the balance of power is shifting there. That's what we're talking about.
E. Michael Jones, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests. That's Mark Steeds from the Bristol Radical History Group. Also to Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre, and to E. Michael Jones, who's written the book The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, you just heard from. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazenko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. You can find them on the web at prsc.org.uk, or you can find us via the National Volunteering website, where you can find lots of other volunteering opportunities too at do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.